and I thought for a moment that my leg had been severed, that my foot must be somewhere behind me. I planted a hand on the ground, tried to rise up, discovered that both my legs were whole, even if the left was throbbing with fire, and so I started to run again, but my leg wouldn't cooperate, buckling underneath me. As I fell again, I saw who had struck the blow. There was a soldier on my left, behind me, kneeling behind his large shield, and there was a spear in the grass alongside him. He had swung out and struck me with the haft as I ran past. The Sildoon was glancing into the woods, eyes searching for the archer or archers out there. The arrows had been coming so quickly, even I had begun to wonder if Soph had recruited others. He was measuring, weighing the risks against the rewards, when I heard the thunk of another arrow, followed by a scream. It had hit a wooden shield and pierced the arm that held it. I forced myself up again, told myself that I would make it, on one leg or two, it wouldn't matter. I had to make it to the woods. We had horses there. I grabbed my father's rib-loving sword and started to rise again. The pain was sharp, up and down my shin, and I felt blood dripping into my shoe. Still, it wasn't broken. I was hobbled, but still moving, and with each step, the woods got closer. Suddenly, I was bowled over, again landing face first in the dirt, the air blowing out of my lungs in a rush. A body was on me, heavy, and a splinted vambrace was on the back of my neck. I struggled to move, but I was gasping for air, and it was useless. The soldier lifted his forearm long enough to crack me in the ear with his elbow, and then he dropped it on my neck again with more weight behind it. The sun and sky were blocked out, and a shadow fell. He must have swung his shield over the both of us, although I couldn't really see, my eyes filled with dirt, tears, and more dirt. His sweat dripped on me, and then I felt his breath, just next to my ear. He said something in Sildunian that I, of course, didn't understand. Did Sofjian give herself up? I had no idea just then. I was somewhat occupied. The soldier on me was much larger, much stronger, and my arms were pinned underneath me. I hoped silently but very fervently that I hadn't stabbed myself when I landed. I turned my head, if only a little, spit grass and dirt and a little blood out from a bitten tongue, and still unable to breathe, began to wriggle with panic. He mistook this for struggling to escape and smashed me in the ear again with his elbow, again demanding something which I interpreted to mean, stop struggling, or plague yourself. I reined the panic in enough to stop fighting, and though I'm sure he was doing me no favors, he shifted his weight a little, no doubt to swing his legs further behind the shield and keep them arrow-free. But it was enough of a shift that I managed to gulp in some air. All I could see of the world was a small strip of grass beneath the rim of the shield. I managed to pull in a few more breaths, hoping that I lived long enough to know that my father's murderer was dead. And so I stared at that slit of light, taking what breath I could. The soldier leaned over me and whispered a question, which marked him as an idiot that he hadn't realized that we spoke no words in common. Not understanding, I told him as much, but he seemed as equally frustrated with our communication problem, so I got another elbow to the ear. He repeated his question, whatever it was, as if I were being intentionally dense or enjoyed being beaten. I asked, "Did you try to struggle?" before realizing how foolish it was. Irritated, he replied, "If there had been any way for me to lash out at him, I would have. But I was helpless. I hope she shoots you in the face," was all I could muster. He might not have understood the words, but the tone was clear, and it earned me another elbow to the ear, the hardest so far. Everything went black. When my vision came back, I was unsure how much time had passed, but he was still on me, still breathing the same, and nothing else had changed, so I guessed little. My head was throbbing, my ankle was on fire, and I'm sure my ear was the size of a horseshoe. I tried to look underneath the rim of the shield, hoping to see something, anything. It wasn't long before I was rewarded. I heard boots, several of them, and in a few moments I saw four of them in front of my strip. And then a voice, the captain's. He issued an order in Sildunian. Though it belonged to a small man, this was a voice that was accustomed to being obeyed. And it was, immediately. The arm lifted off my neck and I was pulled to my feet. Dizziness buffeted me, whether from lack of good air or being beaten in the head, I don't know. And I almost fell, but the soldier who had so generously pummeled me grabbed my shoulders and kept me upright. There were three more soldiers positioned between us and the woods, their shields locked together. I could see none of their faces, but their helms swiveled left and right as they searched the trees. And then the captain wrapped one arm around my chest and put a dagger to my throat. For a mad moment, that seemed more humorous than terrifying, and I had to stifle a laugh. The captain called out, "It's over. Step out now." The seconds passed, all of us peering into the woods, and nothing happened. Part of me hoped Soph had fled already. Another part hoped she loosed one more arrow, nailing the captain in the face. But a moment later, Sofjian stepped out of the trees, bow raised above her head. The captain looked at her and called out, "We have been ambushed by two children? Remarkable." And that was it. We seemed to be on the edge of victory, but we were both captured. Still, we recognized that possibility, embraced it even. While we both hoped to escape, the true goal was to ensure the murderer lay dead. Almost sadly, I said, "But he didn't, did he?" Raylar waited a long time before answering. "No, Aki, he did not. The captain told the soldier to pick up my father's sword, which had been lying beneath me. The soldier held it up for inspection. The tip was covered in blood and dirt. The captain clicked his tongue in the roof of his mouth. "A fine weapon," he said. "Truly, very fine. Where did you steal it?" I didn't answer and felt the dagger on my skin again. "I don't toy with you, boy. One of my men lies bleeding, maybe dying because of it. I would know where you got it." By now, Soph was 10 feet away, and she heard the question and provided an answer. "Don't hurt him. The man your murdering dog shot, that was our father. The sword is his. Will your man die?" The captain replied, "A family affair, is it? How interesting. He very well could die. You would do well to pray to your gods to prevent it, because if they don't, there will be no saving you. No, no saving at all." Sofchian stopped a few steps away. Hands still on her head, she said, "I hope he dies. But I hope he dies slow. He deserves worse than my father." To the soldier holding my father's sword, the captain said, "A remarkable people, but not altogether intelligent." To Sofchian he said, "Perhaps you did not hear me, girl. If he dies, you die." Sofjian dropped her hands to her side. "My father is dead, and my uncle, the one you shot as he tried to avenge my father, he might die too. If he does, he will have taken 5 days. I hope your man takes a 10-day. "That does sound like her," I said. "Indeed, it does. But her desires were immaterial, as were mine. The man did not die by my hand. Not that day. Not ever. He was killed in a raid along the Injurian border years later. I was captured, and though not selected in the traditional choosing, became a jackal's slave. and as you surely guessed, being scholarly, a Memrodon in the Jackal camp identified Soph's latent abilities and claimed her.
And your priests? Your people? What did they do? I asked.
They must have cried out against not only the lack of justice, but your abduction. They did. But they did not attack that day. It was only the following year when the Sildoon returned to the islands. My uncle, tough old root that he was, somehow recovered from the wounds he endured. He led the Orlu seeking vengeance, and wiped out the entire Sildoon choosing company.
I thought about the tale, and how painful it must have been to relive it. The murder the other day, the botched revenge and abduction today, especially since Bloodsounder enabled him to recall it with cruel clarity. But that alone didn't explain all the shared bitterness that had unspooled between the siblings in the years to follow. Sofjin had mentioned the conflict years later, and Braelar's lapse or failure there. I turned to ask the captain about that. But he was gone, his departing footsteps drowned out in the rush of the bizarre lake below.
Chapter 19. It took ages, but it felt like my mind had finally quieted enough to let me slip back into sleep, when commotion woke me up again. I blinked and rubbed my eyes, and it was early morning, judging from the sun on the floor outside the chamber. The Sildoon were mostly up already, and then I realized the cause of the upset. Dozens of human slaves had arrived bearing food, as the deserter guards towered silently, watched them hand the bowls and trays out. No matter how awful a situation you found yourself in, an empty stomach only made it worse. A few of the Sildoon had attempted to speak with the slaves as they accepted the food, but the language barrier shut that down quickly enough. And when a soldier persisted, the sudden presence of a looming deserter stopped any conversation attempts immediately. I stood, stretched, and was about to walk over to the nearest slave when I saw Bolto a little further away and changed my path. He recognized me when I stood in front of him, and after glancing around to be sure no deserters were paying attention, whispered in the odd variation of old Anjurian that I mostly understood.
You still live? That is good. You eat?
He handed me the bowl, which appeared to contain some kind of thick soup, a spicy broth filled with diced roots and crescent-shaped beans, and I took a robust chunk of dark bread as well. I made sure the deserters weren't paying any attention, and said as quietly as I could, mouth barely moving, "The trap by the door. Is there a way to avoid setting it off?" He seemed uncertain about my use of trap, so I tried again. "The alarm. Noise, sound. When you approach the doorway. Can we stop it?" Bolto turned pale, handed out a bowl to another Sildoon who eyed me suspiciously, and then said, "Don't ask. Leave the door alone." I said, "I have to. We must escape." Bulto shook his head and pursed his lips as he knelt down to the large tray he'd carried in to retrieve more bowls and bread to hand out. After another Sildoon moved off, he said, "There is no escape. You cannot." I wasn't sure if he meant that we shouldn't try, or that it was pointless to. Looking around, I caught Venduro's eye on the other side of the room and gave him a pleading look, and then inclined my head to the slave. It took him a moment to understand what I meant, but then he gave a small nod and walked a little closer, bowl and bread in hand. Turning back to him, I said, "We cannot stay here, Bolto. We have to return home. There must be a way." Bolto handed out another bowl and some bread, and there was only one more bowl left. He shook his head again, more urgently this time. "There is no return, no escape. You..." I heard a crash and looked around. Venduro had accidentally dropped his bowl, no doubt to attract the attention of the closest deserter who must have noticed me lingering near Bolto. Venduro was kneeling down to pick up the wooden bowl,
but two slaves rushed over, obsequious but insistent, as they began to clean up the soup with rags, and another approached to offer the lieutenant a new bowl. The deserter grabbed the slave by the shoulder and made him cry out, then shoved him back, soup sloshing over the edge of the bowl. I saw a terrified expression on Bolto's face, and then felt the presence behind me. I was turning around, knowing a deserter was there, trying to think of something to say. The deserter gave me a lazy slap to the side of the head that sent me spinning once before I was flat on the floor, my skull feeling like it was split in two and spilling my brains all over the stones. The giant took two steps and stopped right in front of me. I thought that was it, that he intended to step on my chest and crush every rib I had. But he took another step and grabbed Bolto by the back of the neck and shook him. The deserter was hardly ferocious about it, but still nearly broke the poor boy's neck before shoving him onto his hands and knees, barking something I couldn't understand. And then all the slaves began to withdraw in haste. I reached up, felt the wetness on the back of my head. But it was just a smear of blood, and not as bad as I feared. Venduro was there then, offering me a hand.
You all right, Aki?
I reached up and grabbed it with a hand that wasn't sticky with blood.
Just a little shaken up.
Muldus was standing nearby, and between the hunk of bread in his mouth and the slurring, I could barely understand him as he said,
What were you plaguing asking that little rat about anyway, you dumb bastard?
I replied, I was asking about the trap, by the doorway.
Course you were.
He helped hoist me to my feet with his free arm.
Figured it was good to start the day getting slapped around like a lippy whore, did you?
Braylar walked up, eyes red-rimmed and bloodshot, and it was clear he hadn't gotten any more rest.
You are the only one in the company with the ability to communicate with our hosts, so I do hope you show a bit more discretion next time, Arky. Did you at least learn anything useful?
My head was throbbing, and my stomach was still grumbling, and I said, The slave was frightened.
Sure he was, Muldu said. Didn't want to get flung around like a wet rag. Like he did, on account of you. Guessing he won't be in a huge hurry to have any more chats, eh? So what did he say?
I looked at the captain and lieutenants and was about to respond when Asmorgon, Bank, and Rudgie joined us. Rudgie said,
Heard we missed some excitement?
Muldus replied,
Yeah, Scribbler here decided to pester one of the slaves to see if he had an escape plan hidden in the folds of his funny-looking tunic, and got slapped silly by a deserter. You know, like you'd expect.
Asmorgon laughed as Braylar asked again, Did he reveal anything useful, Aki? I shook my head and immediately wished I hadn't, as that made the throbbing more pronounced. He said there was no escape, and he was scared.
For good plaguing reason, Muldus added.
But I got the sense that he was just terrified to talk at all. There still could be a way to bypass the trap at the doorway. As Morgan said,
What was it you whore sons suggested? Running through the doorway fast? That was it, wasn't it? Running. Fast.
I ignored him and said, The slaves aren't affected. They don't set the alarm off, just like the veil around the city. The deserters have a way of marking who is allowed through certain portals. We can't do anything about that, short of capturing a deserter who can get us through. But maybe there's a mechanism involved, in the stones, the door itself. Maybe we can bypass that somehow. As Morgan glared at me, his massive beard seeming to almost bristle.
Or maybe you just shut your fool plaguing mouth and break your fast and leave the thinking to the likes of us.
Muldu swallowed his bread and turned to the huge man.
Aki saw an opportunity and he took it. Was it smart? No, plaguing weren't. But we ain't getting out of here by trying nothing at all.
As Morgan's eyes narrowed,
Used to respect you, little bit, but you gone soft. Softer than plaguing sand, you are.
Vindiro said. Sand ain't really all that soft.
Everyone looked at him.
Just saying, you get it in your boot, or worse, in your small clothes, ain't any kind of comfort at all. Kittens are soft. A woman's tit is soft. But sand is three kinds of scratchy, especially up on your backside.
As Morgan started to reply, but Captain Kilcoyne cut him off.
Aki, while I applaud your initiative, you truly do pick the most ill-advised moments to express it. Next time, you will not operate independently. If there is another opportunity to speak to the slaves, we will coordinate the entirety first. Diversions, questions, approach. I can ill afford to have your brains splattered against the stones. Are we clear?
He might have dressed me down further, if not for the blood about to drip in my eyes.
Yes, Captain, I replied, wiping it off with the back of my hand.
Good. He handed me his bowl. Break your fast, and then clean that wound. We will talk more later.
I moved off away from the others, towards the windows facing the rest of Roxdiniac. I was curious to observe the deserters some more, to try to ascertain anything that might prove useful. I heard the rain falling before I saw it, though it was really a gentle shower. The streets and avenues were strangely empty, save for some human slaves who walked here or there. There wasn't a single deserter, which seemed peculiar on the face of it. But then again, knowing nothing about our mass of captors, it really shouldn't have surprised me. Perhaps it was a religious holiday, or some arcane rule that governed when they could move about freely. Though it still seemed strange that the humans were allowed to roam, navigating around puddles, carrying their parcels, leading livestock, or bearing messages. There were far fewer of them about than in any human city, even a small settlement, but they weren't prohibited access of the street. Heads down, yes, and not speaking to each other if they could help it, but not guarded or watched. I heard footsteps and turned around. Vindiro walked up to the window, peered out into the rain.
Sorry I didn't see what you were up to earlier. Might have been able to save you that goose egg if I'd acted a touch quicker.
No, I replied. The captain and others were right. It was foolish to try to get information alone. If I'd been smarter, I would have waited. But I recognized that boy, had spoken to him earlier, and didn't know when I might get the chance again.
Ah, yep, he said. Foolish. But gutsy, too. Often one and the same, ain't they?
I suppose so. Vindiro looked at the rain falling and said,
Got to admit, Aki, never cared much one way or the other for your kind. You know, the bookish sort, I mean.
He looked at me and added a smile.
That is, we had plenty of learning to do in our 10 year before the hanging, all manner of things. But I only did enough to get through. Never took to it like Cap or Hugh, and sure as hell's wasn't my plaguing vocation like yours. Those other company archivists we had, they were bookish to be certain, but never liked or trusted to one of them.
And they sure as hell's had no guts to speak of. Unless you count the one risking his neck to betray Cap as gutsy.
Which I suppose it is. But not the good kind.
I wasn't sure what he was circling towards.
Thank you, I think.
Ven smiled, then slapped me on the back. I winced, as my head was still connected, and he said,
Sorry about that. What I'm driving at is, Cap is spot on. You proved yourself 5 times over so far, and got more to contribute besides. So you're an asset, to be sure. Don't want to lose you on account of foolish gutsiness. But more than that, just don't want to lose you, period. Got enough of that going on?
I considered that for a moment. But I heard Muldew say that everyone outside the Jackal Tower is either a tool or an enemy.
Vindiro said, Even he's warmed up to you some. Defended you against Ogre more than once, and started training you a bit. Maybe as Morgan's right. Maybe we are going soft, like a kitten.
He laughed.
Not plaguing sand. But more like, seems you found a way to be a part of the Jackals, even without being amongst us the whole time, or going through what we all gone through. You proved your mettle, is what I'm getting at.
I nodded, and while even that sent my skull to aching some more, it felt good. He was quiet for a moment before looking over his shoulder. When Venduro didn't see anyone immediately around, he said,
Got to say, and it hurts some to put it to words, but really miss hearing Hugh and Moll squabble like a couple of old women. Truly do. When we get back to our proper side of the Gold Vale,
he looked at me, and added,
And we will. Going to really enjoy killing me some plaguing Imperial leopards. Those whore sons are going to pay 3 to 1 for every jackal they struck down.
I resisted the urge to say anything, afraid my pessimism would sour the moment. First, we had to escape this ring palace, and if Balto were to be believed, that simply wasn't going to happen.
We stood there in silence for a while, watching the steady but soft rain coming down, and all I could think of was the comrades I'd seen fall now, and how I had no right to grieve them like Venduro or any of the other jackals. I made a silent pledge then that if we ever did make it back somehow, I would find Skilana, and I would make her pay. I might not be a proficient killer like the other jackals, wasn't truly one of them, despite what Venduro said, but I would make her pay for her betrayal and my failure and foolishness. I could do that much.
Venduro's stomach rumbled.
Think they got chickens on this side?
Chickens? I asked, perplexed.
On this side of the Vale? Ain't seen none, but you kind of have to figure they didn't kill off all the chickens. Though who knows? Ain't got horses. Maybe they done away with chickens, too.
I looked at him. Why do you ask?
Could really go for a boiled egg right about now. Where there's chickens, there's eggs.
I laughed and said, When the captain gives me leave to talk to Balto again, that will be my first question. Where, oh where, are the chickens? He chuckled and replied,
Yeah, do that. Important question, that.
There were more footsteps, coming fast this time. We both turned around and saw Rudgie running up to us, face flushed.
We got more visitors. Quit counting raindrops and come on.
Venduro and I looked at each other, and then ran to follow her. Chapter 20 We entered the main chamber by the door, and saw all of the Sildoon gathered, the captain and his officers at the front. Venduro and I made our way through and joined them. When we were near the retinue, Venduro asked,
What's...
But he stopped when he saw the two deserter guards in full regalia just outside the doorway. I peered out and saw armored deserters lining the walls the entire way down the hallway, still as statues. Venduro whistled and then said,
How long have they been like that?
Muldus replied, Few minutes now, marched up, took their positions, and been standing there ever since.
Huh,
Venduro said, capturing all of our collective confusion and amazement in that single syllable. Braelar ran his hands through his hair and looked pained, as he seemed to be fighting off pain or nausea.
I suspect we might finally meet someone of import. Arki, be ready to translate, he called out over his shoulder, not taking his eyes off the doorway. I will be the only other person speaking in this room. Is that understood?
There was a chorus of, Aye, Cap, from behind us. I watched, waiting with the rest, wondering what could possibly happen next, sweating as time dragged on with no movement from the deserters. Was this a prelude to execution? Torture? Our legs being lopped off? Something worse? And then I saw four figures emerging from the stairs we had taken to get here. A slim human trying to keep pace with three giants, one in front, the other two trailing just behind. The deserters lining the hall remained still as the figures approached our room. The human was female, garbed in a close-fitting charcoal-colored robe, marking her as different from the other humans we'd seen in Roxtiniac. The color and cut was simple and severe, and her expression did nothing to diminish the effect. a small clenched mouth, lines on her face, though I suspected not due to smiling, narrowed dark eyes, and pewter hair pulled back tightly away from her face, compacted into some chambered bun. But while she was afforded nicer accoutrements and carried herself differently, she still had the carving or branding on her cheek that seemed to mark her as just a more respected slave. The three deserters were female as well, shorter and slimmer than the male counterparts, though still much larger than even as Morgan, and certainly towering over the human female. The two deserters in the rear were dressed in robes and strips of cloth, with a single spine in a harness on their back, and I recognized one who had accompanied us to the palace and issued orders. But it was the lead deserter who distinctly stood out from the entire group. She carried the longest spine I'd seen, tapping it on the ground every few steps like a staff or long spear. But more than the singular spine, it was the costume and bearing that marked her as unlike any other deserter we'd encountered so far. She had on a robe, somewhat similar to the females behind her, but the cut and layering was different. For one, it left her left breast bare. I'd seen illustrations of women like this at university, from distant and long-forgotten tribes, and, being a young boy, couldn't help but stare with hot eyes. But here, the effect was more disturbing than arousing. While the materials were undyed like all the other deserter garb, hers had far more intricate patterns and subtle textures woven into it, or embroidered on the surface. It was difficult to tell. Over her shoulder and trailing a yard in her wake, she wore a cloak that seemed composed entirely of dead and dried flowers, thistles and cassia, lavender and flax, and probably 100 other flowers I'd never seen before. Given that gardens appeared to be rare, as far as I could tell, the fact that she had a long cloak covered in dead flowers certainly stood out, as did the rustling, sashaying noise it made as she walked, leaving bits and pieces in her wake, like a snake constantly shedding its skin. She had a beaded headdress on that must have required quite a bit of tailoring to fit it precisely around the horns that projected from her head. It covered the front of her scalp down to her narrow, hatchet-like nose, which seemed to only reinforce the fact that these giants navigated just fine without eyes. Muldus whispered,
"Now who the plaguing hells is this Ruta cunt supposed to be?"
Braelar threw him a black look, and the pale boar shut his mouth again. But it was a legitimate question. As the deserters and human approached the doorway, the deserter warriors finally moved, entering in front of her, and taking position on either side. Two or three could have killed every man and woman in the room, especially with the Sildoon trapped and unarmed, so it was more for effect to demonstrate respect than anything. The cloaked deserter with the headdress entered next, followed by the other two giants and the human female, and she made directly for the captain and our small group at the front of the Sildoon. Braelar stood straight, rigid, presenting as formal and confident a posture as he could. The human female surveyed our company, nodded once, and said, in near-perfect Sildoonian,
"You are in the presence of Rilinka Antovia Lilka, the resident matriarch of Roxdiniac, guardian of the Vale, the great wielder. You may call her Matriarch Rilinka if you wish. Less taxing on your tongue, I should imagine."
She looked at Braelar.
"And you must be Captain Braelar Kilcoyne, then."
I'm sure every Sildoon in the room gaped, all save Braelar, who maintained his composure.
"You speak Sildoonian, with impressive fluency. And what do we call you, then?"
The woman replied, "You are overkind, I think. I speak passably at best, not having much opportunity. Certainly not so well as one born to it. Clumsy? Is that the word? It is a challenge for our tongues, you see."
She turned to me and said, in nearly flawless Anjurian,
"More so than some languages, though. Anjurian is less cumbersome? Is that how you say it?" I nodded as she said, "You must be Archimundos." I didn't trust myself to speak, so only gave another small nod. She continued in Sildunian, "As to who I am, it is hardly important. I am but a humble servant to the mighty matriarch. You may call me Nastenzia. As to tongues, Matriarch Vrilinka insists that a few of us study the most prominent languages of your land. We do get such infrequent visitors in this age, but you just never know who might decide to visit. And the matriarch places a premium on good communication." She looked at the rest of Braelar's retinue. "And let me see." Nastenzia turned her head in Muldus's direction. "And these are surely your lieutenants, Muldus, the newly appointed Venduro, and the hulking Asmorgon there." She gave a frosty smile. "Relatively speaking, of course, on the human scale." She inclined her head towards Rudgy. "I'm afraid I don't know your name. I offer my apologies," she added, not sounding particularly apologetic. Venduro blurted, "How do you plaguing know our names at all?" Nastenzia smiled, as a condescending mother might fielding an obvious question from a not-so-bright child. Then she pointed. We looked and saw a shaken Sofjian standing in a doorway behind us, leaning against the frame, as the herald, or priestess, or whatever Nastenzia was, said, "The matriarch was very intrigued to have a Memrodon amongst us, you see, and one who could withstand a direct assault, no less. They were eager to interview that one, and to test her. And such tests can be, well, less than forgiving. Especially to one not especially, what is the word? Compliant? Acquiescent?" Sofjian spoke as if drunk, words furry and lacking her normal precision. "Let them never accuse me of acquiescing." Nastenzia smiled again, chilly and edged. "But when the matriarch wants to know something, the matriarch will know something." She looked at Braelar again. "It was very educational, so we are glad of your visit, but—" Muldu said,
"We didn't come on a social jaunt. Those giant fucks attacked us and killed half our company."
Nastenzia gave the lieutenant a level, disquieting look. "Plain speaking, is it? Very well, broken man. You were on this side of the veil, were you not? You do know my masters constructed it for a reason, I presume. So venturing on this side, uninvited, unannounced, well, that makes you trespassers, interlopers, a pestilence, to speak plainly. And as such, you are lucky in fact that my masters didn't simply slaughter the lot of you. So given that you are guests in the matriarch's house, alive at her whim, I do recommend you show a bit more gratitude and respect. Your presence here is not welcome, and has caused quite a stir. My masters, you see, they are far less forgiving of your kind suddenly arriving like this. The matriarch could simply let them dispose of you, or, how do you say it, husk you? Yes, her advisors urged both, and the veil must be carefully maintained. So, are you feeling more grateful now, broken man?" Muldu started to step towards her, but Braelar put his forearm across the lieutenant's chest and said,
"We didn't know your masters even existed, so you can perhaps forgive us for inadvertently stumbling across their land, regardless of the regard in which they typically hold us. And guests are not usually accustomed to being sequestered, or," he glanced at Sofjian, "viciously interrogated, which is to say nothing of the soldiers you killed. Where are their bodies? Did Matriarch Vrilinka command they be left behind to fertilize the fields with their blood? You see, mayhap, why gratitude might be in cheap supply just now."
Nastenzia nodded very slowly, took two steps back towards the matriarch, and bowed her head. She said something in the deserter tongue, and the matriarch replied, somehow both slithering and broken up by unusual clickish noises.
"What did you plaguing say?"
Asmorgon asked, no less brusquely than Muldus. Nastenzia regarded him. I said, you ill-mannered troll, that the lot of you were going to prove no more compliant than your stubborn Memrodon there. It is my opinion that collegial communication will prove problematic, at least until my master is taking you firmly in hand, which is what I recommended.
As Morgan said, you tell your plaguing bitch mistress that she can cup my huge jewels in her hand. As Morgan,
Braelar shouted,
shut your mouth immediately.
The large man looked at the captain.
Or what?
Muldus and Hughspear had argued with the captain before, but never in front of the men, and never outright challenged him like that. But before anyone could respond, Matriarch Vrilinka snapped the spine down on the stones, stopping the conversation cold. She surveyed the Sildoon, smiled, showing gently pointed teeth, and started speaking Sildoonian.
I detest your tongue, truly awful. Heinous, painful to hear, worse to speak. But I need no interpreter, human. Now, we have much to discuss. There are things I would know about you.
Captain, you and your retinue will follow. That is a command you understand, is it not?
The matriarch started for the door without waiting for a reply, saying something to the two deserters directly behind her.
Braelar looked at us.
Lieutenants and a chronicler only.
He turned to Sofjian.
If we fail to return...
You always return, she said, still somewhat shaken. It is one of your more annoying qualities. But yes, if you somehow fail to, we will do our best to kill as many of the giants before they take out the rest of us.
Braelar nodded.
I expected no less.
Then he turned to follow the deserters in Astinzia. Vinduro was closest, and started after the captain, and Muldus and Esmorgon filed in behind, with me taking up the rear. Muldus turned to his much larger companion.
I'm only going to tell you this once, you hulking horse cunt.
Save your breath. Can't understand what you're saying half the time anyway.
Muldus replied.
You disrespect Cap in front of the men again. You and me are going to have a serious falling out.
As Morgan laughed.
Didn't realize we were all that cozy.
Muldus replied.
Yep. But we're about to get a lot less friendly in a hurry if you pull a shit stunt like that again.
You couldn't beat me in a fair fight even with two good arms, you plaguing mushmouth runt.
Nobody said shit about a fair fight.
He even hobbled, slurring, with a droopy eyelid, and facing a much bigger man, Muldus still managed to hold his own. When his Morgan couldn't think of a reply fast enough, he moved ahead to catch up the captain. We approached the doorway, and paused right before the spot where Benk had been rendered senseless. Nastenzia was waiting in the doorway. No need to be skittish. The matriarch could have killed you at any point. She still might. But be assured, she would not let a door do it. You shall pass. Come. Despite hearing that, I still held my breath as we walked through the portal. But whatever wards were there permitted us to pass through. Unlike at the Godvale or the barrier around the city, I felt nothing but an involuntary shudder. The doorway didn't strike us down with unseen magics, but I'm not ashamed to say the pending interrogation terrified me. I had no illusions about being half as powerful as Sofjian. If we were subjected to anything remotely close to what she endured, I knew I would be husked, or worse. The armed deserters fell in behind us as we marched along. The matriarch and her silent-robed companions were a dozen paces ahead, and Astenzia fell in alongside the captain. I overheard Vinduro ask her,
"So, the deserters, they ain't gods at all. Are they?"
Nastenzia replied,
"Gods?
That all depends on how you define the term. Are they far more powerful than we could dream of being, wielding magics beyond our comprehension, creating something where there was once nothing? Yes. Does that make them gods? That is for you to decide.
but you would do well not to call them deserters. It is something they are sensitive about.
Muldu said,
They ain't gods, and I can think of plenty of riper words for them than deserter.
Nastenza shrugged her bony shoulders. Do not call them gods, then. But, as I said, I would suggest not calling them the latter, either.
So, Vinduro asked slowly, the words stretching out, are there any gods on this side of the veil at all that your giant masters up there serve?
None that I've seen, no, Nastenza said.
So what do you worship, then? Them?
Vinduro pointed at the deserters ahead. Nastenza said, Why would we worship beings who are not gods? Crunching some dried flowers underfoot, I said. But they might be. Gods, that is. That it depended on how you defined the term. She replied, I said it depends on how you define the term. I do not presume to instruct you on religion. Muldu slapped his thigh.
See? Told you they weren't plaguing gods. Even Runeface there can plaguing see that.
Vinduro turned to the captain as we rounded a corner.
Huh. Well, ain't that a kick in the crotch? This whole time a plaguing 1,000 years and then some. And folks been pining for something that never existed at all. Can't say if I'm sad or glad.
Muldus gave a wet-sounding laugh.
We ever make it back, you can evangelize to every dumb plaguing bastard we come across. Spread the word. See how they like hearing they've been frauded since the beginning of time. Love to see that, right before they stick a spit up your ass and roast you over a fire.
Nastenza said flatly, I would not worry over much about leaving. The matriarch led us down another long hall until we came to a stairwell with a massive deserter on either side. As always, there were no doors. As we approached, Vinduro said in a rough whisper,
You're human. Why do you plaguing serve the deserters?
That word, unhealthy word for you, do not use it. And as to why, they have longer legs, and there is nowhere to run. Now be silent. The matriarch allowed us to catch up. Then she started down the spiral stairs, and Nastenza indicated we should follow. Even though going down was easier than up, my legs were still wobbly when we finally reached the bottom. There were some scattered sconces on the walls, obviously to aid any human slaves that had to use the stairs, but fewer than in any normal human castle or tower, and I proceeded carefully to avoid slipping and twisting or breaking my ankles in the deep shadows. But I was about to discover I had no idea what dark was. There was a single doorway at the landing, and unlike all the others in the citadel, this one had a thick wooden door, currently open. I heard something beyond that took me a moment to place, gently lapping water. The matriarch and the two attending deserters kept walking into the chamber beyond, along with 4 guards. Nastenza moved closer to the captain, lowering her voice as she said, Your eyes will be useless beyond. Stay close to each other, and remember, whatever befalls you, she did not bring you here to kill you. You should survive this, but do not fight it. It will go easier. Braelar said,
Are we supposed to believe you're suddenly looking out for our overall health and happiness?
She gave him a chilly stare, her face mostly obscured in shadow with a torch on the wall several steps above us. We are all still humans, are we not? A deserter near us hit Esmorgon in the back with the flat of the haft of his spiked weapon. The brute nearly spun around to confront the giant, but Vinduro and Muldus both restrained him. Braelar said,
Well, it is rude to keep a host waiting. Let's follow without any incidents like getting impaled or bludgeoned to death, yes?
We walked through the doorway and into another stone hallway. I looked back and whatever weak flickering light was showing along the bottom was quickly snuffed out as well. And the last thing I could make out at all was that the hall took a sharp left. Feeling my way along the wall, I walked blindly until the hall disappeared. We were in some underground vault or chamber, but beyond that, the blackness was now absolute, and I couldn't even see my hand in front of my face. I had no idea about dimensions or what could possibly be waiting ahead. The sound of moving or splashing water was louder. Vinduro said, quietly,
"Plaguing dark, ain't it?"
Muldus answered, just as quietly,
"Real plaguing astute."
The Sildoon in front of me took a few hesitant steps, and I forced myself to follow, though walking into the inky unknown was as terrifying as anything I'd ever done. Matriarch Vrilinka called out from somewhere 30 or 40 paces ahead, her voice alternating between rasping and sibilant.
"Step forward. The problem with foci is that they do sometimes overstep. But Nustensia was absolutely correct about one thing. I did not bring you here to murder you. Intentionally, at least. Step forward. Step forward."
I heard some more footsteps in front of me, small ones from the sounds of it. I moved forward slowly with my arms straight out in front of me, shuffling along until my hand hit something, and I nearly yelped. As Morgan said,
"Quit playing grab-ass, you tiny fuck."
The voices echoed wildly here, but that still did nothing to tell me about how large a space it was, really. I waited until I heard As Morgan move. Part of me wanted to stay as close to the Sildoon as possible, but my fear of the unknown in the chamber was balanced out by my fear of As Morgan's temper. After a moment, I scuffled forward again, listening, straining to hear the captain and his men in front of me. There was more soft splashing ahead, rhythmic, like small waves. Was it an underground lake? A pool connected to the bizarre lake in the center of the Citadel compound? Something else. My mind started racing, one fear colliding into another. What else might be in the room besides our deserter hosts? How deep was the water ahead, and what might be lying beneath the surface? What did the matriarch intend to do to us? If this was what Sofjin experienced, if I would live to walk back out of this room. Vrilinka said,
"There, stop."
There were no more footsteps in front of me, and it sounded like I'd fallen a little further behind. So I took a few more steps until I closed in on the sound of someone breathing heavily, and then stopped as well. No one else was moving. There was only the breathing, and the still, distant sound of water striking some unseen shore. The matriarch called out,
"You have entered my land, uninvited, and I would know why."
After a pause, Captain Kilcoyne said,
"We were fleeing enemies on the other side of the veil. We had no intention of entering your lands, being unsure if even attempting to do so would prove mortal folly. But we had no other options at the time either. So, desperate and trapped, we crossed the veil."
The matriarch's disembodied voice seemed to come from everywhere at once.
"And yet you did not cross back at the first opportunity."
Braelar said, "That is untrue. We intended to continue north until we were confident we wouldn't encounter our enemies on the other side again. We were forced to navigate around a river, and that is when we encountered the Grove, and your kin. They attacked us on sight, and we defended ourselves."
There was a laugh that was jagged with clicks not made by a human mouth.
"So, a large armed band of humans, all defenseless victims. Is that what you would have me believe, fragile human? Perhaps you understand my skepticism,"
Braelar said. "You do forget. We humans from the other side revered you as gods. Well, revered and hated, on account of that abandoning business that features so prominently in our theology. But gods nonetheless. Do you really suppose we armed ourselves, crossed the veil, and went hunting for gods for sport?
Vrilinka was still chuckling and clicking.
I am unfamiliar with the subtleties of your awful tongue, but that struck me as somewhat thornier than expected.
You prefer straightforward and unadorned? Braelar asked. Very well. We did not cross the veil to challenge, assess, or explore, and certainly not with intent to create more enemies. But some blood was spilled on both sides, mostly ours, and then you wiped out half our company with a much smaller group and imprisoned the rest here. So perhaps you can see why I am skeptical that you consider us any threat at all, Matriarch.
No one spoke right away, and the sound of breathing and rippling water was magnified. With each passing moment, I began to fear the worst. When Vrilinka finally replied,
The focus was correct. You are a pestilence, or plague carriers, much like the birds or vermin that on their own could not damage you, but have proven over time to carry a disease that nearly wipes you out. A simplification? Yes. Entirely accurate? No. But that is how the majority of my people view you. So you see, when an armed band crosses over for the first time in history, there is bound to be some alarm. My council has already called for your execution. Many times, in fact. So, your very presence here is something of a conundrum. That is the word, is it not? Conundrum. So I must ascertain the state of things.
Braelar asked,
You are not speaking of the plague that ravages our land from time to time, are you? What pestilence do we carry that can harm the likes of you?
Vrilinka's voice seemed to somehow expand, as if coming from all directions at once, and even seemed to be echoing in my skull.
Your memories, Sildoon. Your virulent, turbulent, colorful, poisonous memories.
But before anyone could respond, I experienced the oddest sensation. Though my eyes were still useless in the deep black of the chamber, I suddenly saw an image in my mind, or several flickering shards of images, though unlike anything I'd seen before. I saw the outline, the texture, the contours of a long four-fingered deserter hand, flexing, closing, flexing, closing. It was as if I somehow saw the hand, but bleached of all color, and with a wealth of details I could never have seen with my own eyes. The tiny individual hairs that made up the deserter's hide, shifting, rippling, as the muscles underneath moved to form what passed for a fist. The veins and the flesh taking on new trajectories as the flesh clenched. I heard someone, probably Vindoro, say,
Plague me.
But it sounded very far away, as if it were an echo of something he said from hundreds of yards away, something distant and weak and immaterial, or possibly something I recalled from a distant time, though part of me knew that wasn't the case. I had the powerful feeling of being a deserter, looking at its hand, but that was impossible too, as they had no eyes to do so. And then the sensations shifted further, and I felt utterly unmoored. The image of the hand seemed to become less substantial, ghostly, until only the faintest flicker of an outline remained. And then it shot out away from me, quicker than a bolt, quicker than anything. Not just directly in front of me, but on all sides all at once. 100,000 outlines of that hand, maybe more, loosed into the depth everywhere around me. I felt my stomach churn and twist, and was immediately nauseous, as my mind had difficulty making sense of what it was experiencing. It was like when you spin around as a child so many times, you can't see anything on your final twists, and it feels as if you were looking everywhere at once. With human eyes, it was impossible, and yet the sensation remained, the outline of the phantom hand flying off in all directions, faster than anything. And suddenly returning, so forcefully I raised my hands in front of my face to protect myself. I knew it wasn't real, or at least wasn't a physical thing that could harm me. But it felt as if countless wasps were flying at me from every direction at once. This happened again and again, and the nausea increased.